Music by Giovanni Battista Fontana, his Sonata No. 15, played by Il Giardino a Monaco. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you've found it interesting, and thank you so much for listening. Next week, James Jolly is back again with his own choice selection. I'll be listening at home while raiding my own shelves for my next appointment with you, which will be in 3 weeks' time. In the meantime, enjoy your listening, and do join James next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock. Here on BBC Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
To mark Palm Sunday, as part of this year's European Broadcasting Union's special day of music, Collegium Vocale Gent joins the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra to perform Bach's Mighty St. Matthew Passion. Live from the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, Bach's St. Matthew Passion. Today at 4 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And now, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the novelist Charlotte Mendelssohn.
Charlotte Mendelssohn's novels are in danger of making you laugh out loud on the train. The absurdities of family life, the excruciating embarrassment of being young or clumsy or not quite English enough, that almost universal feeling of never quite fitting in. There are 4 prize-winning novels thus far, and the latest, Almost English, which was longlisted for the Booker Prize, comes out in paperback this spring. Charlotte, one of the reasons your books are funny, I think, is that you do write so well about embarrassment. And I wonder how that started. Are you someone who gets perpetually embarrassed, or have you been embarrassed very easily?
I always think I've got a very low embarrassment threshold. I'm fantastically clumsy and quite self-conscious, and seem to have little understanding of where my body is in relation to the world and door frames and really all inanimate objects. So, and I also have no sense of direction. So this is a horrible combination for somebody who is very easily embarrassed. I'm constantly crashing into things and then blushing and then blushing because I'm blushing. And I've realised that one of the things that I most enjoy as a novelist is putting my characters in situations of extreme embarrassment, mainly so I can just think, thank God that's not me.
And actually this extends to music, doesn't it? Because I think you said that going to concerts you find very embarrassing. Why is that?
Well, I really do. I love listening to music, but I can't do it in public because I don't really know what to do with my face. I find other people's reactions incredibly embarrassing too. So if people are sort of slightly humming along in a bonkers way, or you know, or nodding to show that they know all the good bits, I find that incredibly embarrassing. Also, another thing is I'm a terrible giggler. So there's always that slightly vertiginous fear that I'm either going to make myself into an idiot or start laughing hysterically. I just can't do that quiet in public thing.
Well, the great thing about radio is that you can do whatever you like, and I alone in the world will know, while you listen to your first choice, which is the Schubert Trout Quintet. What significance does this have to you?
Well, like most of the music I've chosen, I'll probably immediately start crying as soon as it plays, because my father, when I was a baby, I think, used to sing it to me as a sort of comforting lullaby. And he can't sing, and neither can any of us. So actually hearing it as a piece of played music as opposed to my father going la 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 is in itself quite weird, but I find it fantastically moving, and it reminds me of him, and it reminds me of all the many ways in which he's lovely. But also I was thinking, I know it sounds very weird, but I've always slightly wanted to be a salmon. There's something about the whole sort of fish leaping that's incredibly exciting, and I realise trouts are rather less thrilling. But just even the idea of being a fish.
Do you feel you want to swim uphill the whole time?
Interesting, Doctor. It's more to do with the freedom and the water and the sort of oxygenated water. I realise I've talked myself into wanting to be a fish, and I think we better stop now.
And listen to the music. The theme and variations from Schubert's piano quintet in A, The Trout, performed by Sviatoslav Richter with the Borodin Quartet and Georg Hurtnagel. You obviously had quite a stimulating North Oxford childhood. and I wonder, did you have music lessons?
Well, this is a source of ongoing shame. I did. I grew up in North Oxford where everyone is, you know, basically too brainy to exist. And almost all of my friends, everyone I was surrounded with, could play, I mean, not, this isn't an exaggeration, kind of three instruments, usually to kind of grade eight. They were all in the Thames Vale Youth Orchestra. And so all my friends would be constantly lugging around enormous instruments. So of course my parents got me piano lessons, and I was trying to think how many years I had, but really several years. I had at least three different piano teachers. I never reached grade one. I mean, genuinely. No one even suggested putting me up for it. I was just appalling. And then,
so you did achieve some kind of record.
I think it probably is. I sort of got grade minus one, maybe. I should get some special certificate. So I never made any progress. And then I decided I wanted to push myself even further. So I decided to learn the French horn, and specifically the French horn because it was the most difficult instrument, everyone said. And I was appalling. And eventually my teacher gave up and taught me the Charleston because he could just see there was nowhere to go with this pupil. So, yes, I grew up in an incredibly sort of rich, culturally rich world. Yet when it came to proficiency, I was really a vacant space.
Next, you've chosen jazz, and I think for you, Charlotte, this is something of a secret love affair, because in your household it's not universally admired.
When I listen to jazz, I also have to listen to people walking behind me making gagging noises. Seriously, it's awful. So I've loved jazz ever since I sort of discovered it by myself, aged about 15, and then gradually came to love it more and more. But it is a very solitary pleasure.
What have you chosen?
It was very difficult to choose. Jerry Mulligan is my beloved, but then so are many others. Jerry Mulligan is probably the instrumental jazz musician I love best. And with enormous soul searching, I chose Bernie's tune because somehow it encapsulates for me that private pleasure. Listening to jazz in the kitchen, I'm probably cooking. I'm sort of singing aloud to it, though no one who listens to Radio 3 would recognise that as singing. It's more like lowing. And it makes me happy. It profoundly soothes and inspires me, jazz. We'll be right back.
Jerry Mulligan and Bernie's Tune, with Chet Baker on the trumpet, Bobby Whitlock bass, and Chico Hamilton on drums. So pretty good lineup all round. As you were saying, brought up in Oxford, Charlotte, and went on to study there. But despite that, you've said that you never felt English, really.
No, I don't. And I realise, you know, it sounds strange given that I sound like a pre-war BBC announcer. Actually, this is my opportunity finally to go, this is Henry Hall and the BBC Dance Orchestra. Finally. But I think that if your grandparents or people you've known incredibly well, relatives who've brought you up where you know their accents and their funny food and their funny clothes, it doesn't leave you. You don't sort of forget that.
Well, your grandparents, what was their background?
There's never a quick way to express it. One of them was born in England, but her family were all Latvian. And then my mother's grandparents were Hungarian, or so I thought. And it was only in the course of writing Almost English that I realised that Hungarian was a meaningless adjective for them, because they were essentially sort of Czech Hungarians. But that's not really it either, because they were from essentially Transylvania. Where my grandmother was born is now the Ukraine. Obviously, this happens all over the world, but it's been quite odd for me discovering only in my 30s that all the characteristics of my past, but also myself, that I thought were Hungarianness, aren't really that. It's just generically foreign.
You give a wonderful flavour of life with them in the book. Perhaps you could read a little passage just to illustrate that.
Darling is their usual form of address. Are not their hand gestures a little more extravagant than those found in Surrey, their eyebrows more dramatic, their hair swept back like something from Nosferatu? They seem both more formal and more exuberant than you might expect. Their perfume smells like the air in 100 department stores. And what are they speaking? Nothing you know, no rolled R's or recognisable sounds, but either in an entirely impenetrable language, Kerspontifutesh, Egeshegedre, or a distorted English, full of dactyls which dust familiar words, Piccadilly, or washing machine, or indeed Westminster Court, with snow and fur and darkness.
That gets a wonderful picture across. And in some ways, the book, Almost English, is an elegy for your grandparents. The next music is very much for you, I think, in memory of your grandfather, who used to play the piano.
Yes, the seed of the book was missing my grandparents, really. You know, that particular quality of culture and engagement with the world and suffering. And most of them are dead now. And I needed to make something concrete as a memorial. So, yes, my grandfather was an amazing musician. He was a fantastic pianist, and he used to come to our house, and we had a sort of rubbish old piano. And I remember once someone knocking on the door. They just passed in the street and the windows were open. It was summer, and they could just hear this amazing music. They asked if they could come in and listen. So we had this stranger sitting on the sofa. He played so beautifully, and he was so unpretentious about it. He'd play anywhere, but he was not at all a show off, and he looked fantastic. He had great big dark eyebrows and white Nosferatu hair, actually. And one of my most precious possessions is a very, very, very crackly tape that I recorded of him playing the piano. It's all in a great big blur of Paprika and Chopin. Thank you.
Well, in the absence of the tape of your grandfather, we had Vladimir Horowitz, a pretty good stand-in, playing Chopin's Etude No. 5 using the black keys. It's very witty, the piece, and full of life. But what you write about again and again, Charlotte Mendelssohn, is actually how painful it is to be young. In your case, it seems to have been, but maybe it's true of everybody, but particularly difficult.
I did find adolescence incredibly difficult. But growing upwards, well, I think because I was fantastically square. One of the things Almost English is about, as well as all the other things, is what it's like being a sort of brainy, somewhat introverted, rather earnest child who suddenly is thrust into this world of social sophistication, boys, sex, people who seem to know how to look good and, you know, what alcohol does and things like that, and just not having a clue. And I think I felt very like that. I think an awful lot of us do. I don't know why it was particularly difficult for me, but I regularly think it's so wonderful not being a teenager anymore. I love not being a teenager.
One of the pieces that you listened to a lot, I think, at that time, and it is the most affecting lament, is from Purcell's Dido.
Yes. It was partly, I think, because I was and am very pretentious and a big fan of Latin and Greek and anything pertaining to them. So just there being a piece called Dido in Aeneas was rather thrilling. And in fact, I always think one of the best examples of how bizarre my North Oxford childhood was, the cats who lived over the road from us were called Dido and Aeneas. So I was doomed from an early age. But I also, you know, like most teenagers, spent a lot of time thinking about my funeral. And one of the most delicious things about When I Am Laid is that it's about how people will feel when you are dead, which is a major issue for teenagers, I think. And largely because we'll just be thinking, they'll be going, I didn't realise how wonderful she was. So this sort of exemplified that for me. But at the same time, I just think it's so unbelievably beautiful. And there's something about Emma Kirkby's voice that almost it's her Englishness. Most of the musicians I've chosen are so emphatically not English. Something about her Englishness I find incredibly moving when she sings this. I don't quite know why.
Yeah.
When I Am Laid in Earth, Dido's aria from Act 3 of Dido and Aeneas by Purcell. Sung there by Emma Kirkby, with the Taverner Players, conducted by Andrew Parrott.
There is something, and I do think about it a lot when I'm chopping my onions in the kitchen listening to music, there's something that music does that nothing else does. It goes to your heart, and you can probably hear the thump of my sternum when I do that. It goes to your heart. You obviously, I passionately think, reading is the thing. Reading is the stuff of life. But music just pings you. I often think that when it comes to certain family things, one has, you know, sort of those biscuit cutters with a sort of beveled edge. And it's almost like we've all got a sort of biscuit cutter sized hole over our hearts. It's very easy for the chunk of chest just to fall out and suddenly we're in agonies. Well, the same with music. Music has instant access to the heart in a way that nothing else does.
But also possibly in its abstraction, because it's not pinned down to the specificity, to the specific
I'm with
of
you,
words.
With all those syllables.
That actually we can adapt it all to our own personal need.
I think that's completely true, because you know, when one watches a film, one can be different people. People always say that. I never think that. When one's reading, in theory, one can be different people. But you're right, with music, when there are words sung by one particular person, you are inserting your experiences. It's like writing about sex in books. That's why one should always stop after a certain point, or before a certain point. The same with music. You put in your own experiences, which is why we all find bits of music so unbelievably thrilling, because it means something for us. It's not a general thing, is it?
Cathartic,
but also it's like it's speaking to our past in a way nothing else does.
How did you choose the bit of Bach we're going to hear? Not an easy task, I admit.
It wasn't easy. You know, this Paul Tourtellier version is one I've listened to a billion times. There's something about Bach I find really thrilling. I think of it as quite thinky music. I'm quite keen on things being quite thinky. I have a tiny study, not much bigger than this room, and it's painted a very particular, very dark blue, like this, because I think of it as a thinky colour. And there's something about Bach. I can't listen to music while I'm writing, because then I stop writing. But it engages my brain in a really thrilling way. It's like having a massage on one's brain. And the structure, albeit one I don't understand, I find incredibly interesting. I don't understand what he's doing, but I love that he's doing it.
Thank you.
I've realised that I'm Glenn Gould, because honestly, there's something very strange going on. I've realised that the pieces, that the Bach and the jazz that I've chosen, I sort of know all the notes without knowing what they are. I sing along to them all the time. And maybe that's why I don't like concerts, because I'd be thrown out. There's something about the sort of structure and the purity of there just being a couple of instruments that, given the strange format of my brain, that I don't really understand what's going on, but I love the depth. There's such emotion in just one beautiful, lovely note of that cello.
Well, of course, there's quite a strong connection between Bach and jazz.
Yes.
There are repeated patterns, for example. And Bach used to have something called a figured bass, where he just, which was rather like having, you know, jazz players have a chord map, a chord chart or sequence of where they're going to go. And then they improvise on top of that.
This is so great. I feel like I'm having, finally, the first music lesson I'm actually listening to. Can we have a series?
We heard the first two movements, the Adagio and Allegro, from Bach's cello sonata in D major, Paul Tartellier playing the cello, with Robert Veyron Lacroix playing the piano. A country singer next, Gillian Welch. I think some of the audience would know her from the Coen Brothers film, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And that has a great soundtrack. But how did you discover her, Charlotte?
Well, I prefer to think of her as new country, if you don't mind, because I'm very frightened, apart from Dolly Parton, whom I revere, I'm very put off by the whole general country label. But I discovered her sort of by chance. I'm very, very keen on anthologies of either music or poetry. And someone made me a CD back in the olden days, and there was one song by her on it. And again, it's the plangency, it's the purity of her voice. I have all her albums, and she's quite miserabilist, which I love. There are a lot of songs about dying orphans. But this song is actually an anomaly in that it's not about a story. This is something else. This seems to be a sort of song about the theory of songs. But for me, it's also about life, and it's about writing. It's about whether one can ever be original. I love listening to it, and I've listened to it so often, but particularly during very sad times. So it immediately evokes horribleness for me, but in rather a moving way.
Gotta be a song left to sing. Is everybody can a thought of everything? One little song that ain't been sung. One little rag that ain't been wrung out complete. Got a little left. One little drop of falling rain. One little chance to try again. One little bird who makes it home now and then. One little piece of endless sky. Gotta be a song left to sing. Is everybody can a thought of everything? One little note that ain't been used. One little word ain't been abused a thousand times. In a thousand rhymes. One little drop of falling rain. One little chance to try again. One little bird who makes it every now and then. One little piece of endless sky. One little taste of cherry. One little week in paradise, and I start thinking, gotta be a song left to sing. everybody can have thought of everything. One little song ain't been sung, one little rag that ain't been wrung out completely yet, till there's nothing left.
The purity of that one voice moves me in a way that orchestral music, big band music, rarely does. Obviously, sometimes, but there's something, I suppose it's like reading, it's you and the author's voice.
Gillian Welsh and One Little Song from Soul Journey. And by the way, all the details of today's recordings are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. It seems, Charlotte Mendelssohn, as though you always wanted to be a writer, just took rather a long time to get going on it.
Yes, that's true. Well, I wanted to be a writer like other people want to be an astronaut, in that it never occurred to me there was the tiniest chance that I could be. Because basically, I sort of thought one had to be Keats. I thought one had to be a male, brilliant, inspired person. And I wasn't. And I had this fantasy of me, as a writer, being a writer. There was no writing involved. And I would not have dared to think that was possible. And it was only when I was in my early-ish 20s that I realised, finally, the only way this might be possible was actually just to sit on my bottom and write. That's the crucial bit, the actual writing.
The next song is Sondheim. And in one sense, I guess it's about the process of finding identity.
It is. For me, it's about loneliness. It's about whether you can bear to connect. You know, someone you have to let in is one of the most wonderful lines in it, but it's full of wonderful lines because it's about the pain of engagement, I suppose.
It's about also the central protagonist, Robert, a 35-year-old bachelor, and at the show's end, he realises that being a lone wolf, if you like, isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Yes, and it's so wonderful because it's basically saying, is it harder to be alone or together? And the answer's both.
Someone to hold you too close, someone to hurt you too deep, someone to sit in your chair to ruin your sleep.
That's true. More than that.
Is that all you think there is to it?
You've got so many reasons for not being with someone, but Robert, you haven't one good reason for being alone.
Come on, you're onto something, Bobby. You're onto something.
Someone to need you too much. Someone to know you too well. Someone to pull you up short, to put you through hell.
You see what you look for, you know.
You're not a kid anymore, Robbie. I don't think you'll ever be a kid again, kiddo.
Hey, buddy, don't be afraid that it won't be perfect. The only thing to be afraid of, really, is that it won't be.
Don't stop now. Keep going.
Someone you have to let in. Someone whose feelings you spare. Someone who, like it or not, will want you to share a little, a lot.
And what does all that mean?
Robert, how do you know so much about it when you've never been there? It's much better living it than looking at it, Robert.
Add him up, Bobby, add him up.
Someone to crown you with love. Someone to force you to care. Someone to make you come through. Will always be there, as frightened as you of being alive. Being alive. Being alive. Being alive.
Blow out the candles, Robert, and make a wish. Want something. Want something.
Somebody hold me too close. Somebody hurt me too deep.
Somebody sit in my chair and ruin my sleep and make me aware of being alive, being alive. Somebody need me too much. Somebody know me too well. Somebody pull me up short and put me through hell and give me support for being alive. Make me alive. Make me alive. Make me confused. Lock me with prayer. My days, but alone is alone, not alive. Somebody crowd me with love. Somebody force me to care. Somebody make me come through. I'll always be there, as frightened as you, to help us survive. Being alive, being alive, being alive.
I love Sondheim really passionately. I also know practically every word that Cole Porter wrote, and quite a lot of his peers, but there's something about the cheeriness of most musicals that I cannot stand. So what I need is kind of bleak and brainy and funny, but not cheerful. I read somewhere that Leonard Bernstein said, they say you have to be either gay or Jewish to write a Hollywood musical, and I'm both. And that's one of the quotations I keep on my quotations document on my computer to cheer myself up. When I think, kind of, what am I doing? I can't do this. I look at that and think, oh, I've got a few of the cards here.
Dean Jones from the original Broadway cast singing Stephen Sondheim's Being Alive, the final song from the musical Company. Well, you were just talking about yourself, and in fact, you have settled into a family life with your partner, Jana Briscoe, and two children, both writing at home. How does that work with two people writing in the same house?
Basically, it works largely thanks to having a room of one's own. This is one of the best things about adulthood, is that finally I have managed to have an extremely small room that's just mine. And it's all gone rather peculiar. It's all red and blue, because somehow those colours contribute to thought, I think. And it's full of strange objects that used to belong to my grandparents, which have nowhere else to go, so I have to have them like a shrine. And that's where I write. And so I can keep my materials. I can keep my inspiring photographs, and no one will laugh at me.
You said you don't actually listen to music while you write.
No, I've always thought I should, because...
No, I think you shouldn't, but go on.
Well, I've often thought if I could listen to Bach, then I will... listen to that when I'm not thinking about the writing. That's where my brain will go. But it doesn't work, because either I get to the end of the CD and I haven't heard a single note, or I'm listening to it and then I fiddle around on iTunes and the whole thing just goes. I think I just need to be tied to my chair to write. So music and writing, I think I'd explode.
I think that's completely understandable, because I think Bach requires one's entire attention. It's not background music, it's not wallpaper.
No. I also am not one of those people who can write in somewhere noisy. I try not to be precious about it, but I can't write in a cafe, because then I start listening to people's conversations. I need to try and get into that world.
Well, since you're not writing at this very moment, we can indulge you with a C major prelude by Bach from the Well-Tempered Clavier, played by Daniel Barenboim.
Thank you.
I think the controllers of Radio 3 need to realise that something very important has happened here, which is that I finally started vaguely to understand a tiny bit about how music works. And I think really Michael needs to become the music doctor and help, unfortunately, people like me, because I've realised that the music I love is very repetitive, it's variations on the theme as discussed, or it's incredibly pure. And there's something weirdly soothing for me.
The first prelude in C major from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, Book 1, played by Daniel Barenboim. Do your children have music lessons, or will they?
Yes, and they're just as brilliant and committed as I was.
Well, maybe as they grow up listening to jazz on Radio 3 in the kitchen.
I'm hoping.
It won't need to be a secret.
I'm trying to brainwash them into liking jazz, actually. I really do, and Gillian Welsh and my other new country favourites. I really try, but I think that, you know, when one is a child, Jerry Mulligan's probably beyond it. My father used to play modern jazz quartet, and I think that's probably manageable. That and Tubby the Tuba.
But the writer in you has won out, because the song you've chosen to finish with, Charlotte Mandelson, has some of the best lyrics imaginable.
I'm glad you think that. I'm constantly telling people or shoving copies of lyrics, particularly by Cole Porter, at them, just going, don't you think this is brilliant? If you read the lyrics, Cole Porter is so wonderfully funny, but also so subtle. And I've listened to this song probably for 25 years now. It only recently occurred to me it's basically encapsulating everything I most hate about the world. You know, disgusting power and sexual politics. It's very hard as a feminist to realise how much I love this song.
If a custom tailored vet asks me out for something wet, when the vet begins to pet, I cry hooray. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. I've been asked to have a meal by a big tycoon in steel. If the meal includes a deal, accept I may. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. There's an oil man known as Tex, who is keen to give me checks. And his checks, I fear, means that Tex is here to stay. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. From Ohio, Mr. Thorne calls me up from night till morn. Mr. Thorne wants cornered corn, and that ain't hay. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. From Milwaukee, Mr. Fritz often dines me at the Ritz. Mr. Fritz invented Schlitz, and Schlitz must pay. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way. Mr. Harris Plutocrat wants to give my cheek a pat. If the Harris pat means a Paris hat, baby. But I'm always true to you, darling, in my fashion. Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way.
In a funny way, I've realised that it's, I don't know, there's something, it is all about the darkness, isn't it, expressed in the light way. She's too light, but it's about the wit on top of the dark. I've realised too that it's a song about flirting, and I think flirting is part of the, you know, the leaven of life. It's about engaging with people. It's about enthusiasm. You know, I was thinking when I was listening to the, with every single couplet in that, I thought, oh, this is my favourite. And then this one's my favourite. It's awful in so many ways, but it's about having fun.
We heard Ella Fitzgerald singing Cole Porter and Always True to You in My Fashion. Thank you so much, Charlotte Mendelssohn.
Thank you. It's been such fun.
Michael Barclay was talking to the novelist Charlotte Mendelssohn. And you can find all the details of her music choices, along with details of how to download programmes in the series, on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael goes to the National Gallery for a special edition of Private Passions with the gallery's director, Nicholas Penny. And that's at midday next Sunday. Private Passions was produced by Elizabeth Burke, and it's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3.
The 18th Century season on BBC Radio 3. Every weekday at 11 o'clock, conductor Christian Kernan joins me, Susie Klein, for 15 Georgian pleasures. From Handel and Haydn to the less familiar, we'll be introducing the music enjoyed in Georgian Britain. And on In Tune, from 4:30, Sean Rafferty is in Buckingham Palace in search of Georgian objects from the Royal Collection. You can download our 18th Century season podcasts via the Radio 3 website or catch Essential Classics and In Tune every weekday here on BBC Radio 3.
We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 on FM, we're on digital radio, and we're live online in high-definition sound. It's a minute past one. The news now read by David Cornett.
Gunfire and explosions have been reported in the Ukrainian city of Slavyansk during clashes between security forces and pro-Russian militiamen who seized control of government buildings. The Interior Ministry says that one security officer has been killed. Slavyansk is one of three towns in the eastern region of Donetsk where there's been violence. Kiev says it's carrying out an anti-terrorist operation in Slavyansk, which was launched after America expressed concerns to Russia about what it called attacks orchestrated by Moscow, which the Kremlin denies. Scientists sitting on the United Nations panel on climate change say that it's possible for global warming to be averted without living standards having to fall. They say that diverting hundreds of billions of dollars from fossil fuel industries to renewable, cleaner energies would mean delayed economic growth, but this wouldn't be a sacrifice. Keith Vaz, who chairs the Commons Home Affairs Select Committee, has called for an investigation into the failed prosecutions of the Conservative MP Nigel Evans and other high-profile figures. Mr. Evans says the Crown Prosecution Service should pay his legal costs. He was found not guilty of sexual offences last week. Partial results from last week's presidential election in Afghanistan suggest that there's a tight race between the former foreign minister, Abdullah Abdullah, and Ashraf Ghani, who was the finance minister. With just 10% of the votes counted, Mr. Abdullah has received 42%, while Mr. Ghani is on 37%. Israeli riot police have clashed with Palestinians on Islam's holiest site in the Old City of Jerusalem. Several people were arrested at the compound of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Britain's Mo Farah has lost out in his attempt to win the London Marathon. The Olympic gold medalist came eighth. The men's event was won by Kenya's Wilson Kipsang. The winner of the women's race was Edna Kiplagat, who's also from Kenya. And the weather, it'll be windy across northern areas with further showers, especially over western Scotland, where some of the downpours may be heavy. Elsewhere, it'll be generally fine with light winds and strong sunshine, making it feel warm. BBC News and weather at approaching 4 minutes past one.
And it was read by David Cornett. Well, now on Radio 3, another chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert given at Wigmore Hall in London. It's introduced by Louise Fryer.
The Emerson Quartet have been together for almost four decades, and no season at Wigmore Hall would be complete without a visit from them. They're based in New York State and last summer had their first member change since 1979. Their new cellist is a name not unknown to most UK audiences, I'm sure, Paul Watkins. And the cello features prominently in the first of the two works the quartet are performing for us this lunchtime, the Quartet No. 14 by Shostakovich. It turned out to be his penultimate string quartet, and it's paired today with the final quartet by another great 20th century composer and friend of Shostakovich, Benjamin Britten, his string quartet number 3. Shostakovich had dedicated his 14th symphony to Britten, and in 1972 he used a trip to the UK to take the opportunity to visit Aldborough. His 14th quartet dates from that time, although it wasn't completed until the following April. It was to be premiered by the Beethoven Quartet. Shostakovich had already completed 3 quartets for the ensemble, each dedicated to one of its members, and this last was to honour the cellist Sergei Shurinsky. And it's the cello that introduces the first theme, accompanied by a drone on viola. The mood is uncharacteristically light, but it's soon shot through with tension and anxiety. The slow movement quotes Wagner, the prelude from Tristan and Isolde, at least in passing, and ends with a slow dance which stutters to a conclusion. The final movement takes the same tune Shostakovich used in his 8th quartet, an aria from his opera The Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, which introduces an ironic sense of nostalgia. A single line recalling earlier themes is then parceled out between the players, who each contribute just 2 notes, then 3 notes, then 4. It's up to the cello to bring everyone else back up to speed, and later to drive the piece towards its serene, if uncertain, ending. The quartet's in F-sharp minor, and is perhaps the most whimsical of Shostakovich's late quartets. And that applause greets the arrival on stage of the Emerson Quartet, violinists Eugene Drucker and Philip Setzer, viola player Lawrence Dutton and cellist Paul Watkins. We're going to play the string quartet number 14 by Dmitri Shostakovich. ¶¶